Good morning, everyone. And sorry, I think it's afternoon already. And it is not Nicholas Lorimer. It is indeed Sara Gonne today, standing in rather hurriedly. So, having done this sporadically, if I suddenly hit a button and you disappear, do not hold it, please, against me. But I have very erudite colleagues to join me today. Marius Root, welcome.
Hello, Sarah. Nice to be here.
And John Endres, our boss, chief. Welcome.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for having me back on the show. It's always good to speak to you and colleagues, and also to our viewers and listeners. I always enjoy reading their comments.
Right. Well, today we are going to look at probably from the not the sublime, just the ridiculous, or largely the ridiculous. And that is this. The ANC has said that it wants more whites. Sorry, I'm putting it a bit crudely. Basically, they're seeking to attract more white, Indian, and coloured voters, and that they have as they have adopted a document presented by a group of white, Indian, and coloured members, I assume, as part of its strategy to regain the two-third majority it once enjoyed. According to the document, the ANC, which was formulated and led by ANC member JP Pretorius, whoever he may be, the party mandated the members to mobilize farmers, student, and other community members to vote for the party in their numbers across the country. We're not entirely sure who Mr. Pretorius is. He's just referred to as the coordinator of the ANC National Group Crisis Committee, and a crisis, I imagine it is. And they've got coordinators in the provinces and subcommittees, and apparently doing all very well. And what the ANC is doing is it is targeting 20% from the white voters with an unspecified percentage from the other race groups. Marius, I'm going to put you ahead of the boss. How likely is this to succeed?
Yeah, I don't think it's particularly likely to succeed. I mean, the ANC has for a while it's really paid lip service to non-racialism. Still styles itself as a non-racial party, but we've seen in various statements of senior figures always speaking about our people, and it's pretty clear that our people means a particular race group in South Africa. It doesn't mean all South Africans. We've also seen there's often quite a lot of hostility to things such as Afrikaans schools and so on, especially from somebody like Panyaza Lesufi in Gauteng. And there has been, I mean, it's also actually Afrikaans does seem to be under attack quite often, but I think it's also there has been a lack of even trying to support other indigenous South African languages. And we've seen, I mean, this is probably something that happens around the world where English becomes a bit more prominent. And I think that that's a bit of an aside. But even if the ANC had to get 20%, if 20% of whites had to vote for the ANC, I don't think it would make that much of a difference. Whites only make up about 7 or 8% of South Africa's population now. I think whites probably vote in higher proportions than other race groups. I think, I mean, that's partly, there's a number of reasons that partly because the population's older, well, the white population's older, and older people generally vote more than younger people and so on. But I think even if the ANC had to get the 20%, if 20% of whites had to vote for the ANC, I don't think you'd see them, there wouldn't be a significant jump in ANC support. And yeah, I don't know where, I mean, if the ANC actually wants to get white voters, I think the best thing it can do is, actually start reforming the economy, getting the economy to 5-6% economic growth. When I mean, the ANC reaches a high watermark in 2004 when it won nearly 70% of the vote. That's
Somebody doesn't want Marius to speak.
must be the
Marius,
person with the load shedding button.
it's maybe the ANC, maybe they're more powerful than we
But
thought. Sorry, Marius, I disappeared a bit.
no, from yeah, and yeah, so I don't think there'll be, yeah, if the ANC wants to get white voters back, it should, look at the pragmatic economic policies followed in under the time in the Thabo Mbeki years, and then I think that's the best can do instead of just releasing another report and trying to on how to do this. So I think that's the best thing can do, but I think the ANC's probably lost most of most Indian coloured and African voters in South Africa, I think. But I think and they've probably been carry on losing a lot of the other voters, but it looks like we've lost Sara, John. What do you
It's
make
just
of all this?
that we've got triple redundancy on these calls. So we could lose two
Exactly.
speakers and one person can hold a monologue so long.
Apologies,
Exactly,
guys. This is an excuse.
Welcome back.
John,
Yes.
the two words come to mind, snowball and hell.
Well, let me give you a different perspective. I think this
Okay.
is actually a great idea. This is such a wonderful move by the ANC, and I'll tell you why. Because for a long time, I've said that the ANC is in crisis. If it was a company, it would be facing bankruptcy. It would need a turnaround specialist to be appointed who thinks of radical things to do to the organization to make it function again. And for years and years, we've seen nothing of the sort from the ANC. We could see them dipping lower and lower in the polls, but there's nothing happening. And I just couldn't believe it. So I'm actually a little bit relieved to see that they have a national group crisis committee, which I assume is related to the crisis of the elections and not any of the other crises in the country, but just the election crisis. That's a good sign. At least, you know, they're thinking about it. And then I think, secondly, this also isn't a bad move in the sense that even though, as Marius points out, getting 20% of white voters to vote for the ANC won't really make that much of a difference, what it does do is weaken the main opposition, which is the DA. You know, the DA has been very successful at getting minority voters to vote for it. It's I think, running close to potential in those minority groups. And for the ANC to just chip away a little bit at that support base is going to be really very tough for the DA to deal with. So I think this is actually quite a smart plan. I don't know if it can work. I think it's as you say, a snowball in hell, a bit unrealistic unless they really adopt some fundamental changes, which we know are so hard for them to do. Mm. And Marius mentioned economic reform. That's the one. And the other obvious one is the non-racialism one.
Mm.
And in that piece you quoted, they do say, you know, the ANC has drifted away a little bit from its non-racial bearings, and it wants to get back to that. And, you know, this is an opportunity for non-racialists in South Africa to say, ANC, we're so happy that you've come to this insight. You're exactly right. You should be non-racialist, but you still have 116 race-based laws on the statute books. How about you start by tackling those? So in a way, I think this is a fun little story, quite interesting, with some complexities to it. Not entirely a bad thing, especially from the ANC's point of view. And we'll have to see if anything comes of it. At the moment, it does look a little bit like a snowball that's been floated as a balloon that then turns into a lead balloon. So it'll probably come crashing down. But it's a fun little story. And if there's any inclination within the ANC to head back towards non-racial waters, that should be encouraged. Sarah.
I mean, given the fact that the three groups, the white, coloureds, and the Indians, have it's not a just recent dissatisfaction. It's been a dissatisfaction over time, and frankly the racism in the ranks of the ANC that's been vocalised. And I mean, it goes back a bit, but white monopoly capital certainly got things really going, I mean, the ANC has done so poorly. I mean, all the things you've mentioned that it hasn't managed or has managed into the ground or whatever it may be. These are not groups that are going to forgive it that quickly. They may have a different attitude to some of the opposition parties, but the ANC, Maurice, what's your view on that?
I think you're right. But also, I think even just this kind of strategy shows also the depth of thinking. You know, speaking about whites, colours, and Indians, if they, you know, all like some kind of a homogenous group. I mean, there's about 4.5 million whites in South Africa, about a similar number of coloured people, and 1.2 million Indians. You can't speak of them as just these singular blocks of voters. I mean, people have different views. Of course, white people, the DA is the most popular party amongst the white South Africans, but Freedom Front Plus as well. I mean, you still get white people who vote for the ANC, even the EFF. I don't know if you find them outside somewhere like Tara, but I don't know. But you do get people who, also look at coloured South Africans too. And there's obviously, with any group of people in the world, there's a wide variety of ideologies and ways of thinking and ways of thinking about fixing problems, South Africa's problems. So yeah, I just, instead of thinking about how can we get whites and colors and Indians to vote for us again, think about how we can get people to support us again. And as that comes down to, it's actually bread and butter issues, as I said, it's economic growth. Because if this economy was growing at 5, 6, 7% a year, the ANC would be, it'd be unstoppable. It would be nowhere close to, you know, people would be getting 60, 70% of the votes as used to get in the early 2000s and so on. So it also just shows you, it's a very, I think, shallow way of thinking about people and our voters to just assume that, you know, there is such a thing as a white block vote or colored block vote or whatever the case is. And people, I mean, people vote for various parties for very complex reasons. And, you know, I think there might be some people who look at the ANC and decide, you know, I'm not going to vote for them because of, you know, I feel that they're a racist party. But I think also a lot of people will be, you know, that might not bother them, but the ANC is running the country into the ground, economically speaking, and things like Eskom. And those things are also important, I think.
I just pick up on the one point, Pat, go back to John. John, given the fact that the FMF has foreseen 0.1% growth and we need 5% or more, surely we're just in such trouble that they're going to struggle even with black voters.
Exactly. And I think, you know, Marius gave a good non-racial response to this challenge. It's quite appropriate. And the point he's making is, you know, if you produce good governance and economic growth, it'll appeal across the board. And you'll catch some white voters, you'll catch some black voters, Indian and colored. So that's actually what you need. You don't need to address specifically to any of the race groups. You just need good governance and good performance. And 0.1% is not it.
It's barely performance at all. Talking of that, let's go on to our next topic, and that has to deal with the crisis facing the steel, metals and engineering industry, and a report just put out by CISA, which is the large federation body to which employers belong, talking about some of the, you know, just the effects of the rise in input costs, job cuts and production declines that is just leading to disaster, not least of which because of intensifying electricity crisis. And I mean, one knows that these industries are electricity intensive by and large. Even a small organization, a small company that is involved in these industries will invariably use or need proportionately a fair amount of electricity available, which it's not. They also talk about the ripple effects of above inflation rate increases in electricity tariffs, not to mention the load shedding. And they forecast the percentage of production to be lost was gone from 2%. Not just on our desire to export, but the much touted localization by Abraham Patel. John?
Well, I think that article highlighted quite a few interesting points, which you've mentioned. And one of the most interesting to me was the point about investment. So if you're a metals manufacturer, for example, and you have a certain CapEx budget available to you, which could be your own money, or it could be borrowed money. And let's say you want to invest it in expanding your factory, or you want to buy new, more efficient machines, all of which would grow the economy and create jobs and, you know, just boost output, make South Africa more competitive. At the moment, you can't do that because you've got to take that money which you had planned to use for those purposes and put it into survival effectively. So you've got to buy a big diesel generator. In manufacturing, I assume that there's not too many metals manufacturing companies that use solar because the current draws are so very, very large. And that is concerning because I think, as has been probably raised on the show before, low investment levels are one of the huge problems for South Africa and for our economy. We're sitting at 13% or thereabouts of gross fixed capital formation, far too low to sustain economic growth rates that are needed in South Africa. And this is a very tangible and practical example of how load shedding reduces the investment that is needed within the economy and strangling growth. In some senses, I guess where businesses have been able to set up solar systems, they've got a big upfront spending. Once that plant has been amortized, they will effectively be running on free electricity, which is, that's a good situation to be in. But the people with diesel generators are not in that position. They have to keep buying diesel for as long as there's load shedding, and that is going to hurt the manufacturing industry. So that's quite a concern, Sarah.
No, the cost of it's the cost of diesel is a great inhibitor in this event. And in a survey done by CIFSA, they found that 42.6% of companies had cancelled a collective 2.64 billion rand in investment and expansion, because essentially, and which would also create over 1,600 new jobs, because essentially that money has had to go into keeping things, simply keeping things going, keeping making available the energy through other sources. All of that sort of speaks to the sort of tragedy, I guess, that South Africa has faced in the investment sphere. That it's not, it's these are the consequence of the policies that are discouraging investments. Is it doesn't just discourage outside investors from coming in. It prevents or discourages or both local investors from investing, and that local investment is crucial. Maurice, would you agree with me on that?
Yeah, I would. Just as an aside, I was actually having a drink last week at a pub, and I was speaking to the owner. He spent 1.7 million rand on diesel last year, just to to be able to keep his pub open. And I mean, I don't know about the statistics around this, but I'd imagine that the money that you put into buying diesel for your generator has far less of an economic multiplier effect than going to paying other suppliers and expanding, I don't know, stock behind your bar or giving increases to your staff and all that kind of thing. And then obviously there's the these costs have to be, I'm sure this guy probably tries to absorb some of the costs, but it's probably not feasible for him to absorb all the costs. So I'm sure some of the costs then get passed on to his customers, which increases the cost of the drinks and the food. And then that's again, people have a little bit less disposable income, which also means fewer economic multipliers going through the economy. So I think there's all kinds of, knock-on effects of this kind of thing. And I mean, even as you said, with the issue of investment, if people are simply not investing, there's obviously, if you're not investing, there's no economic multiplier effect from that investment because it's simply not happening. But there was an interesting article from the head of Remgro. I forget what his name is now, but he said Eskom is basically going to be irrelevant in about 5 years' time. And I think he's most probably right. Is, Eskom is privatizing, is going to be privatized whether people in the ANC like it or not. It's an issue of reality coming up against ideology, which often happens in a lot of places. It depends whether reality wins or whether ideology wins. And when reality wins, then countries sort of start reforming. They start seeing rapid economic growth. I think India is a very good example of a place where reality won over ideology. But ideology is one of reality in a couple of places. Zimbabwe, it's ideology beat reality there. Also beats ideology also beat reality in Venezuela. And we've seen what happens when people carry on sticking to an ideology or way of thinking which goes against all evidence in front of you. It leads to economic collapse, destruction of wealth, massive exoduses of people. But at the moment, as I was from the way I see it, I think reality is does have the upper hand in South Africa over ideology at the moment. And I think there's even some pragmatism within the ANC. If there wasn't, I think we would have seen these various attacks on the Reserve Bank would have become much more intense, and I think we would have seen somebody like a fairly pragmatic person like Lesetša Kganyago, the governor of the Reserve Bank. I think he would have lost his job long ago, and would have put the money printing taps on in the Zuma presidency. And that hasn't happened, so I think there is some cause to think that reality is still on the front foot in South Africa over ideology.
Well, I don't know about still, but maybe it's returning. And I think that you make a good point. I mean, one hasn't heard anything said about since I think the last conference where somebody brought up, nationalizing the Reserve Bank, and the comment came and went. So I think the force of circumstances is creating a sense of reality. But you just to sort of also hook this this subject onto your pub experience. The problem that much of the metals industry is facing is that the demand is so low they can't pass the costs on to their customers or portion of the cost to their customers. Finally, John, just to mention that the CISA found that a third of its sample were working on short time due to the electricity crisis. But even more concerning was that half of the companies implementing short time had already reduced headcount, resulting in about 9,400 layoffs. Things have got to be, from my experience in the field, things have got to be pretty bad if you are retrenching in the private sector, and the only comments from the union movement, the union involved, SAFTU is the federation and NAMSA is the union, is that is pretty much agreement. You're not seeing huge or any anti-retrenchment strikes. Your comment?
I think it's because the reality of the situation is so irrefutable that unions have to agree on the assessment of reality with business people. So they come to the same conclusion, which doesn't always happen. Mm. So I think, yeah, it is quite a concerning thing. And I think at an economy level, what we're seeing is that energy intensive industries particularly are suffering and may decline as a share of GDP. So we saw the irrigation farmers, for example, going to the president and pleading for exemption from load shedding at certain times of the year when they need to water their fields, for which they need electricity to run to the pumps. And ultimately, you know, if load shedding doesn't get resolved, the structure of the economy is going to change. And we'll see that there won't be so many heavy manufacturing industries, aluminium smelters, for example, metal bashing industries, irrigation farmers, because all of those actually need cheap electricity in order to work. And if they all fold, then, you know, it becomes a different kind of economy in South Africa, one in which only energy efficient and lower energy consuming kinds of industries really stand a chance. There's going to be disruption involved in that, job losses, as we're seeing. And hopefully on the other side of it, if economic growth picks up in that reconstituted economy, then there would be a return of some of those jobs in a different guise. Mm-hmm. But it is going to be, you know, traumatic and disruptive, as we're seeing already.
So. Yeah, I think what you're saying really brings to the fore what the threat of deindustrializing the country, which to some extent has happened already. But it's that sense of you deindustrialize and you see in your mind's eye that Venezuela and Zimbabwe, etc. Here's another item. And it reads like this. It was from a newspaper report. Eskom chairman Mpho Makwana has dismissed reports that up to 80% of Eskom staff are corrupt. He says it's impossible. Apparently, he was commenting on a Financial Mail report, and I don't think many of us would have trouble. You know, believing that 80%, which I think would be about 33,000 Eskom employees, are corrupt, but it's probably not so. But apparently this arose from comments made in a meeting between, I think it was NAMSA, National Union of Mine Workers, and Pravin Gordhan. And they had two key messages. Load shedding is a direct result of corruption at Eskom. So in other words, corruption is the main driver of load shedding. And that between 70% and 80% of Eskom's 42,000 employees are engaged in some sort of corrupt activity. And in this respect, he pretty much confirmed the views of the former Eskom generation executive who resigned a few months ago, Rulani Matabula, who said fraud and corruption are the power utility's biggest problems. Morris, do you think 80% of Eskom's employees could possibly be corrupt, and that as a result, our major problems are caused by corruption?
Look, 80% sounds a bit high, but the problem is it doesn't sound impossible. which I think is very telling about what's happening in South Africa. But I think probably why you've seen this kind of metastasization of this tumor of corruption and so on is because, as far as I can tell, there's no real consequences for anybody doing anything, any wrongdoing at Eskom. And I think with something like Eskom or any big organization, when there are people that are stealing or, you know, being corrupt or what have you, that kind of infection can spread. I think even, you know, most people would think that they won't break the law and so on. But we've seen, I mean, through history, ordinary people can often do wrong things. And when, you know, for whatever the reason is, I mean, I don't know about the human psychology behind it. And I think that's something that's happened at Eskom, where, you know, there's probably a couple of rotten apples in the bunch. You start doing wrong things, stealing, cutting corners and so on. And if you don't stop that infection immediately, if you don't get your antibodies there, which are, you know, police and law enforcement agencies and so on, then that infection spreads. And eventually that causes the whole organization, which, you know, we can use the metaphor of a body, to die. And I think that's what's happening at Eskom. It had an infection of people who were corrupt and breaking the law. Nothing was done to these people, so this infection spread to, you know, as I say, people who probably consider themselves pretty decent people. But, you know, if you don't see any consequences, like, well, I can also do that. I could also do with the extra 2 million rand a year or whatever the case is. And I think we've seen now this infection has spread through Eskom, and we all know the consequences of what's happening with that organization, which, you know, for better or worse, is one of the most important organizations in South Africa. If Eskom collapses and there's no plan B, then South Africa's going to be in a lot of trouble. And yeah, I mean, similar to what I was saying earlier, it does seem that there is maybe some, Eskom could maybe slowly be coming out, but if 80% of the staff there is corrupt and nothing's happening to people who are corrupt and stealing and so on, then yeah, I think Eskom could be in very big trouble, which means South Africa's in very big trouble.
Well, as our commentator Swan Princess says, that given the red tape around procurement in the public sector, most of the value chain has to be corrupt to accomplish looting. What Mr. Makwana went on to say is, you know, they've put in place all sorts of measures and task teams, and that because of the task team, 3 former Eskom board members have been arrested and 2 have had assets forfeited, and 2 former Eskom chief executives are in court, and a former chief financial officer has been stripped of his rights as a chartered accountant. He's not specific, so I'm not sure how far back he's talking, whether he's talking about Brian Malefi and his cohorts who have appeared in court. John, do you think what do you think is going to take to prevent or limit the corruption? Or are we seeing it already? Has our Minister of Electricity gone to the head of the mafias who are running this and saying, you know, guys, hold on a sec, give us some space to repair things?
Well, I think what's interesting in this is that we're probably beginning to discern what the actual role of the Minister of Electricity is. You know, I think everybody was wondering a bit, why do we need another minister if we've already got public enterprises and energy and finance and the Eskom board all trying to fix load shedding, and now we've got another minister, so what's the point? But I think what we're seeing now is that his job is to spin the narrative. And so we've seen him say at Kusile, I think it was, that corruption wasn't the main cause of the problems, you know, the other problems, et cetera, et cetera. Which most people dismiss, but some people will believe, and they say, yeah, you know, maybe it was technical problems, and if you fix those, then everything will be fine. I think you can also see that his role is to motivate the staff, and that was a point that was mentioned since the beginning of the year, where people said that all this talk about corruption at Eskom and demonizing the entire labor force of that organization was dragging down motivation and making it harder to generate electricity. So Minister Ramakgopa has to go there and has to be enthusiastic and get people working again. And then another thing he also said was that the splitting up of Eskom into those 3 units of generation, transmission, and distribution wasn't really that much of a priority. And so what all of this tells me is that his job is actually to make sure that things don't change too much, but rather that Eskom continues more or less as it is, and, you know, hopefully doesn't have imposed too much load shedding on South Africa before the elections. And after that, we'll see what happens. But for now, that's, you know, that's a good outcome. And that is his job, is to make sure that that happens. Spread good cheer, point out that corruption isn't so severe, which the board chairman has now endorsed, and say that the splitting up of the organization isn't so important, which will make it more difficult for independent power producers to be brought on stream. At the same time, of course, he's also in an environment where load shedding has gone down, the intensity has gone down. So he can be optimistic, he can be cheerful, he can say that no radical changes are needed, because look, load shedding is already getting better, you know, so why is everybody so worried? And it's all fitting together quite nicely in a way for Eskom. But the thing is, as we, you know, started this conversation about reality and ideology, ultimately the reality does come back to bite you, and you can't really spin your way out or past it. Reality is what ultimately determines outcomes. Sarah.
I'm going to give you 30 seconds, Maurice, just to talk about yesterday's cricket. It's one can't not.
Yeah, well, it was obviously a good good chase by the Proteas. And as I was saying beforehand, a couple of records, highest ever chase in a T20 international, highest ever aggregates in a T20 national for both teams. And yeah, I've got to say I'm feeling a little bit more positive about South African cricket than I was a year or two ago. I saw David Beddingham, who's a very good batsman, has said he wants to, and he can play for either England or South Africa. He's actually now recently said he would rather play for South Africa, which I heard a couple of years ago. And I think it's because we have been new selectors, new coaches and so on. So I think I'm feeling a bit more positive about South African cricket than I was a couple of years ago.
Great stuff. I mean, when the cricket does well, almost nothing else matters. Thank you very much for joining us today in the little sort of dance of screens and glitches. And I may still make a further glitch in the outro. So just hang on to your hats and, you know, whistle Dixie, whatever works for you. And again, thank you very much for joining us. And hopefully Nick will be back to restore some sanity to things. Thank you.